ring the bell, it's like this big tension is lifted, and everything, you know, it's like a spring that was really, really stretched out and begins to relax. The energy in the room relieves, it's such a sense of relief. It reminds me of a joke that Howard used to tell, I'm sure you've heard it. He says, why does it feel so good to hear the bell ring? Because then we can stop waiting. Which leads me to my constant wonder, why do people do this? Why do we sit in this posture, quiet and still for designated periods of time? And it's a good question to revisit regularly, because nothing should be done just as a habit. And I'm hoping that it's not done because it's a discipline that you want to conquer, you know? I mean, there are times when the whole mind-body process is really activated and stressed out, and we're in suffering, and we still stay true to the form and wait for the bell to ring in spite of everything. And hopefully there will be some burning purification process that relieves us of whatever hurdles were in our mind-body process for that moment. But my only answer to why we do this is so we have this exquisite opportunity like no other to explore who we are. It's the most fundamental question in the whole history of spiritual investigation. Who are we? And so this position and being in a sangha with the support, knowing that everybody else is still sitting, so you might as well carry on, is a great opportunity to have no distractions from who we are, what is going on, what is going on in my body, what is going on in my mind, and what is the relationship between them. So aside from the pleasure that sometimes does happen of experiencing that unified feeling of just being stable, there is also the other leg of the practice, which is investigation. So we practice stillness and silence so that we can, for just periods of time, arrive at a place of what in Buddhism is called equanimity. I call it stabilization, where the mind goes quiet, the body feels like it can relax in the position, and for the moment, everything feels deliciously okay. And that's called concentration, where we bring the scattered energy of our mind-body process. We gather it together so that we have this focus, and it can be like a laser beam. And with that laser beam, we can investigate how we put our moment-to-moment inner experience together. And principally, we can investigate the very, very noble Buddhist truth of nothing is stable. I'm sure that you've experienced when you come to sit, the mind is going because there's been so much input, so much stimulus, so many things to think about, to resolve, to worry about, question, to go round and round about. And the body holds a stress of all of that. So that's the first thing we encounter when we actually commit to a sitting practice for the moment. Well, body stiff, agitated, not finding the right position, mind going on and on and on. And then we say, well, you know, in the Buddhist world, it's all about cause and effect. So what is the cause and what is the effect? It's a little bit like the chicken and the egg thing. These days, people feel that any distress or discomfort in the body immediately gets translated into mental activity. So all the thoughts that arise are somehow the afterglow of some kind of bodily discomfort. But we don't realize how much bodily discomfort we're experiencing from moment to moment because we live in our minds. So the second thing that happens, which is startling, is that when we sit, we are in full-on confront with our body. Where does it feel loose? Where does it feel tight? Where is it agonizing? You know? How is my breathing? Are my shoulders? How's my back? How are my knees? All these things come up when we're committed to a long practice without moving. And some of these are very, very prominent, and some of these sensations are incredibly subtle. But even the subtlest bodily sensation causes the mind to move, because the mind has a purpose to resolve whatever is going on. So it's like this very eager little horseman that comes in and says, I can do this, I can make it better, and starts making noise, mental noise. And what does the mental noise consist of? The father, the mother of mental noise is our brain and the way that our brain is organized. Principally, our brain is organized to seek for patterns. So the five senses are the doors to the outside world. We see, we hear, we taste, we feel, we smell. And it would be nice if it was just in that sequence, but all these things happen simultaneously and continually. And causes some kind of disruptive feelings in the body, subtle or prominent or anything in between. And as from little infants we grow up, we begin to look for patterns in this input. And the mind looks for organization among these patterns. So already there's a habit, there's a map being formed. And it feels good to have a map because we feel oriented. We feel we can deal with ourselves, we can deal with each other, we can deal by being in society together effectively and get what we want. And give what other people want. But within the Buddhist practice tradition, one of the teachings is that all of that is delusion, that it's not real. It's not real. And there's a part of us, the deep soul, the wisdom seed inside of all of us that knows this. And that's why we're here, aside from the suffering. So that deep seed of wisdom inside of us, knowing that all of the patterns that have created the map that we negotiate our experience with from moment to moment, from day to day, is not real, has the wisdom of realizing that everything is in constant state of movement, that there's nothing really substantial. And that is an uncomfortable thought for the mind-body, because the mind-body lives in this real world and wants to survive. And survival demands that we can predict, control, manage. So as we watch and investigate the mind-body process, and we begin to identify the patterns, that make up the map, that tell us who we are and how we exist with others and what our life is about and why we work and why we play and what we can count on and what we should be afraid of. The insight that that is not real is somehow really, it's shattering at first. It's a shattering experience. Because we want certainty, we want security, we want reliability, even if it's a lie. If we're honest with ourselves, we will swallow those lies until life shakes us so hard to the roots of our being that we must let them go. So the other aspect of investigating in the Buddhist practice is to learn how to manage our inner experience so that we can stay balanced, we can gain some sense of stability, and we can be more in alignment with our most dearly held values about what is important for us. So the principle, the underlying principle of that investigation is an understanding of the insubstantiality, the delusional quality of what we experience from moment to moment. Because it gives us a chance to step back from our thoughts, step back from our opinions, step back from our feelings and emotions, and say, there they are, but they're not real. And having stepped back, it's like unplugging the energy that keeps them churning around as patterns that keep reiterating and deepening. So that we actually are now open to, we have more avenues, more pathways. We can actually choose variations on the themes that we seem to be stuck with. So with that level of flexibility, we actually begin to taste what's called freedom or liberation. Liberation from the rigidity of the map that we have developed in order to give ourselves the experience that we can count on things to be the way we want them to be if we just work hard enough, if we're good enough, if we practice enough, if anything is enough, you know. So one of the great benefits of sitting is being able to slow it all down so that it doesn't come at us as a torrent, so that we can kind of stretch it out in time and space and pixelate it and say, oh, here comes that thought, here comes that whole set of feelings, here comes that person in my aversion, my attraction, whatever. And to be able to say, well, that's not really real. That's just a habituated pattern from a false map. And that loosening is our potential for becoming liberated, for becoming free. And what do we have when we're free, when we're liberated? Nothing. Emptiness. Which is also what Buddhism talks about, which also makes people terrified. The existential feeling of there's nothing. Well, then there's nothing. What can I rely on? What does this all mean? But within the context of the ancient Vedic system that Buddhism arises from, that emptiness is like a womb. It's like an eternal pregnancy that all things arise from and finally surrender back into. So emptiness is actually a kind of fullness. You could say that emptiness is a place where generativity arises from, creativity, real genuine creativity arises from emptiness when we're free of the patterns of our mess. We actually live in a state of surprise, a state of being awake. Every moment is new. Even that generalization of continuity seems to get shattered. And we're left with what in Buddhism is called spaciousness, of the ground of being. And when we can identify with that and then taste it, experience it, not too attached, if we close in around it, it goes away in a flash. But that spaciousness of the ground of being is the only thing that is reliable, that is real. And that we have the very thing that we are practicing to discover. So it's not really a destination, it's something that can arise at every moment. And I know that everybody in this room has had a taste of that. And there's some kind of ease that happens when we fall into that space for just a second. We're free of having to be who we want to be or who we should be. We give freedom to other people from having to be who we want them to be or who they think they should be. And we give freedom to life to unfold in exactly the pristine way that it is unfolding, without being followed by our disappointment and our attachments and our desires. That's liberation. And in a sense, I'm hoping that that's really what you are all here to experience and why we put ourselves through this state. Because I know that some people suffer a lot. If it isn't the body that's hurting, it's just boredom or impatience or wondering, why did I get here? Why did I come here? You know, what am I doing? Because we have had enough of a taste of that freedom that we wanted more. We wanted even more than listening to Trump's victory speech. You know? We wanted even more than whatever else we might be doing with this time. And I think it's a wise choice, my own personal opinion. So it's always, always good to be here with such a lovely, rich, full sangha of people dedicated to this quest. Because I know it can be difficult. I know there's a lot of stress and trying that goes into it, effort, and a lot of wondering and doubts. And overcoming all of those things takes a lot of courage. So that's my preamble. I would love to have a conversation with you, know where you are at and what we can do to clarify things for each other through conversation in the room. Either based on what you've experienced tonight or what does bring you here every week. Just sharing so that we get a sense of our common effort and experience on this path to liberation. So what does it mean for something to be not real?
I can't find it.
So there's a sense in Buddhism that the only thing that's real is what is stable. If there is changing stuff, then there's an unreality. You can't count on it. And since everything is in a constant state of dynamic change, there's really nothing that we can count on. And from the Buddhist perspective, that means that nothing is really real. The only thing that has substantiality is that which is not changed by conditions. We're constantly being changed and affected and drawn in to different states by the conditions that impinge. And the conditions are infinite. Yes, I know. Unreality is it's not the toughest one. Anicca is tough, but the toughest one is anatta, which is there's not self, which is even more difficult a reflection, because we ourselves are always changing in a way, and so our what we call ourself is not real either. So I don't know that it's something that we can understand with our logical mind, but Buddhism is very logical, actually. And what it's pointing to is that anything that we want to rest on and count on is not, it's not a wise position to take. We will be disappointed, we will be hurt, we will have to manage somehow to reconstruct the thing that we've been leaning on as it dissipates. Changes is insubstantial. So it's just within that, the rubric of that definition. Yeah, so we're here looking for what is unchangeable, what is steady, what is the truth that is undeniable, that is eternal, and that is absolute. And now, in some of his traditions, there isn't any. I know. It really leaves us very naked, very raw, and very helpless, like falling through space. And the only thing that can guide us in that feeling is the moment that we are in. Right? It is confusing because we live in a very deluded world, right?
Yes.
And so we attribute incredible value to things that we can't count on,
yeah.
You know. So just the body, we want to count on the body, but the body ages and at some point it dies. So that's our most immediate, our most intimate and immediate reflection on impermanence is the body. But what's interesting is that we are all colluding in this attempt to establish stability. So we build buildings, we have cultures, we send rockets to Mars. You know, we're doing all kinds of stuff that gives us a sense of being in a container that we can rely on. so that we know what to expect and we have a sense of control. You know, if I learn this, if I have the discipline, if I put it into action, and if I'm persistent, then this will happen. You know, we have that as a very powerful pattern that directs all of us. And we're all colluding because we all want to maintain this illusion together. And we don't like people who question it. Well, you know, I know my mom died the same way for 5 years. I know that feeling. And I don't think that being mindless and having the mind melt away is a desirable state. I'm not saying that. That's not an identification between the mind that is open and resists patterns and a brain that is liquefying. It's different.
Well, that's why I start with the volition aspect.
Yeah, volition.
The choice. She doesn't have a choice.
Yeah. We do have a choice.
Yes.
In fact, we have the choice of sitting. And we have the choice of managing our mind-body process while we're sitting. And we have the choice of choosing to sit more because we feel the benefit of it. I hope that that's the reason that we're meditating, because we feel the benefit of it in the rest of our lives. More spaciousness, less, not necessarily less volition, but our volition is informed by different values and different inner states, you know? A volition that is informed by compassion is different from volition that is informed by greed, for example. I don't think that you want to lose volition. I think you want to lose the energy that feeds volition when it's very, very tight and is arising and informed by a map that is driven by hatred, greed, and delusion. You know, the three poisons. So, I don't feel that a person who is, but I don't know, because I haven't been there. I know my mother was very emotionally labile. She's crying, she's laughing, she's crying, she's laughing, doesn't recognize anything. And on some level, it's a little bit like returning to being a baby, you know. And it's a very vulnerable state because our mindfulness is not there. We can't gather our attention and focus it and direct it. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't gather our attention into focus and direct it. I'm saying we want the freedom to choose the values that fuel that mission. And to be aligned with the values means that we're not being triggered by the desire to have things that are unreal, that are insubstantial. You know, there's a certain amount of money we all need, but do we all need to be billionaires if it takes away from other people's happiness and well-being? No. But some people are driven. They just have to be billionaires, especially now. In about 20 years, it's going to be trillionaires, you know. So, the factors of greed, the factors of getting mine and not caring about other people, not having compassion, you know, not having empathy, empathic understanding of other people's experience, we could say through intention. Yeah.
How would that confuse who they go to our nation to go that way and that we didn't follow? Because on one hand, you have to be determined, you have to have a clear goal, you have to pursue, even if your desire to pursue enlightenment, whatever it is, and it's a desire. But on the other hand, you see, we go out, there's all this flow, just let it go and then truly be. It seems very often they're like an opposite side, and it's really hard to find a common ground for the two.
Yeah, I have a simple solution to that. I don't know how deep or true it is, but you know, when you say have to, to me that smacks of an intention that is informed by outside factors. And so I would convert it to want to. That's what I have to do, but what do I want to do? Because want is more of an internal directive than have to. Have to is like being pushed. Want to is being inspired. And a lot of the time, we don't take the time to get off of our have-to world to discover what it is that we really want. Which is one of the reasons that people sometimes drop out for a while, you know? Thoreau goes to Walden Pond. Oh my goodness, this is what I want to do. I just want to spend the days waking up, listening to the birds, investigating all the little details of nature, keeping a journal about it, and reflecting on the society back in Boston and how cramped it is for people and how much misery arises out of that. So if we could go from the have-tos to the want-tos, that would be a great first couple of steps in the direction of liberation. Does that make sense? Yeah? You know, because we're all very driven by have-tos. And sometimes it's worth it to sit back and say, is it really a have-to? What would happen if I didn't? What would I rather do? Who says I have to, you know? So it's good to question things instead of being on automatic pilot, on default. Yeah. Yeah. Well, those things, love and compassion and service, actually unfold as we let go. It's as we let go of the have-tos, then I think that love just naturally arises and compassion just naturally arises. And when we have love and compassion, it's very easy to dedicate ourselves to service. So I think it's kind of like a peeling away all the things that we're supposed to be and have to do. Because they're the constraints that keep us from being in a state of compassion. The compassion that knows that every experience that I have, everybody else has. And that leads to, well, then we're not that different. And as I love myself more, I love others more, and loving them more, I have compassion for their suffering, and having compassion for their suffering, I'm motivated to help if I can, or to be, or to do something. Yeah. So for me, it's a little more other things that are compelling us and driving us all the time. Because it feels to arise from something inherent in ourselves. Yeah, but nothing is not nothing. Because if you understand nothing, then you understand that it includes everything. Right? So, I think you have to pass through the door of nothing to be in everything. Otherwise we're always edited.
My question is very similar to this, but it does that the only the thing I have trouble hearing about that nothing is real is the one thing that does seem real to me is love. I have trouble putting that in the definition of everything. I understand there's times when we don't feel like we love the people we love or this or that, but
yeah. If you think about the way we experience love in reality, it's pretty screwy. there's a lot of sexual attraction, there's a lot of projection, then the person doesn't act according to my projection, then my feelings shift and change, then we have a fight, then I feel weird, then I think shit, But love, that is free, and that is so personalized, has more of a potential for liftoff into the vastness of things than the thing that we identify as love, because, love hurts a lot of it, and through time, love changes, you say, well, my bond, I felt this way so strongly just 6 months ago. Where did that feeling go? Well, it changes. So then there's nothing wrong with change. Change is the truth of things. It's hard for us to flow gracefully with change. We want, wait a minute, something went wrong, I wanted to feel like it was back then, or how did you get distracted? Or you couldn't have really loved me because look at how you're treating me now. It's a complicated world, what we call love. But true love is not so personal. It's kind of like, sometimes I feel I love whoever's in front of me. And so the idea of committed love disappears, And but I know we all want love. That's the one hope that hangs out there and will not die, no matter how much disappointment, how much heartbreak, how many weird situations we've gotten into through the doorway of love. It still hangs out there as a shadow. Come to me. The big promise. And there's a lot of analysis about why we make love so important. And, courtly love supposedly is what we're still into, the couple. And that happened, just prior and during the Middle Ages, supposedly, except for Adam and Eve, but we know what happened to them. Oh, yes. leave that for announcements at the end, because I know about that. I'm supposed to announce that too.
Okay.
They only need to hear it once.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, there's 64 million people on the planet right now that are immigrants and have no place to live in the moment, no milk for their babies, and all the borders are closing down. Yes. It's true, you know, in a way we can't affect, you know, we can't affect the change that we want to see a lot of the time. What to do with that? How to accept that? How to not let it become an emotional burden? You know, how to have expansive energy in the face of that? I mean, I think about it. Me, my mom and dad, we were immigrants from the Second World War. You know, when we came to America. And we were stuck, I think, in Europe until we got the right to come to America. So, you know, displaced persons everywhere. And right now, there's more displaced persons on the planet than there's ever been in the history of this planet. And just yesterday, I heard that Sweden, the big, generous, open-hearted country, has shut the doors on the policy of reuniting families. So there's a mother with four kids in Sweden, and the father and a six-month-old infant girl still in Greece, and they can't meet up. Because, you know, but everybody does what they can do, and everybody feels their limits. And you hear that, and your heart breaks. You know, it's almost too much to bear sometimes. And then there's things that, you know, create hatred and aversion inside of me. You know, the way animals get treated in the world, the dog eating festivals in Asia and in China. You know, so working to stay expansive, hatred doesn't help, aversion doesn't help. Inclining towards figuring out, is there something that we can do besides signing petitions on Facebook, you know. But then it's true, we want to shut out the suffering and the pain, you know. I talk about this stuff with people and they say, no, I don't want to have those images in my mind, you know. Or I tell them something, they say, no, it'll never leave. Well, maybe you should, you know, that's your problem. You know, but the thing is, we're all trying to manage our inner experience so that we can be more expansive, more skillful, more compassionate, and not avert our attention from things just because they make us uncomfortable or miserable. And understanding that, yes, we're very privileged. You know, now more than ever, to be able to live in Northern California and the Bay Area is a huge privilege. Just financially, it's a huge privilege. And to be able to have touched a practice that works for us, that we can dedicate ourselves to, that's like being in a state of grace. And then being able to connect with people and know that there's a place here and people that you can practice with and have a sangha and the support of that, that's an incredible blessing. So the only thing that I can think of is sharing it. You know, we're always trying to share the fruits of our wisdom and our practice, just sending it out into the world, or, you know, contact compassion. You know, walking through our lives mindful enough that when people contact us, they have like a, if they're receptive, they have a little taste of it. That's all we can do. So recognizing our limits, yeah. Because, you know, what proselytizing does, it's been the bane of everything. So, you know, that's one thing Buddhists don't do. Buddhists and Jews, they don't proselytize. You know, yeah. So, it's, yeah, but it, we're really in a crisis right now on this planet. And there's nothing more destabilizing than people trying to move, being completely uprooted, and having nowhere to go. There's nothing more destabilizing. It's not only cruel, but it's dangerous for all the rest of us. So we have to sit in the middle of that understanding and somehow expand in it, instead of contracting and getting anxious and, and my experience is that my practice helps me to do that. So I'm hoping that other people have the same experience. Because we're going to need it. We're going to need it. It's 9 o'clock. The bell has rung. Let's just sit for 2 minutes before with this verse. So maybe we can sit with gratitude, and beginning with gratitude towards ourselves. First of all, it takes wisdom to practice. And to have the persistence to continue, even though the mind and the body can resist, we persist. And as a form of generosity, we want to share the fruits of this practice with all those immediately around us. People that are in genuine turbulence and suffering, with no respite in sight. And for all beings, both seen and unseen, in the whole world, the whole universe. Who knows? conditions that